We're going to get started, our little ladies class plus one. So thank you. No, we would love for you to stay. We would love it. I'm Jillian, and this is Tanya. And we come from opposite sides of the states. So I'm from Tennessee, and she's from Utah. But we met in Haiti, so random. But we met back in 2011. I was living in Haiti at the time, working at an orphanage, and she was adopting from that orphanage, and so that's how we got connected and have just stuck to each other since. We are the co-founders of an organization called Emmaus House, which I will tell you a little bit more about at the very end of this, but basically it is a transition home in northern Haiti that helps orphaned youth coming out of orphanages or coming out of domestic slavery situations or who have been sexually exploited, just helping them to kind of make that transition into adulthood successfully while also recovering from their past traumas. So we will kind of say a little bit more about Emmaus House throughout our presentation and how we kind of came to that and what we do. And then if you want to learn more, we do have a table out in the lobby. We would love to talk to you. But today we are going to talk about short-term missions, specifically how we as Christians can be engaged in short-term missions and have long-term impacts in the places we go and with the people we serve. Before we do that, though, I kind of want to see who we have in this room as far as who's been involved with short-term missions before. So have any of you been on a short-term mission trip before? Probably a good number. Have any of you financially supported somebody to go on a short-term mission trip before? So that's almost everybody, yeah. And then do you guys belong to a church that regularly sends short-term mission teams? So it seems like most of us have some involvement. Oh, I was supposed to go to another slide. See the raising of the hand? Right. most of us have some sort of involvement with short-term mission trips, which is actually pretty common. If you have not read the book, When Helping Hurts, it's a must-read. I wouldn't be offended if you, like, pulled out your phone while I'm talking to put it in your Amazon cart. But they showed a study back in 2006, which I realize is like 13 years ago, so we can imagine those numbers have gone up. But in 2006 alone, America had 2.2 million people go out on short-term mission trips. So these are American Christians at a cost of $1.6 billion. Now that is a lot of people that we are sending out, and that is a lot of money that we are using to send them. And Tanya's and mine question is, has that been worth it? Have we made such significant impacts in the world that amount of people and that amount of money has been worth it?
And we both have been on each side of short-term missions. So we've been on the receiving side and the giving side of it.
There you go. Yeah, you go over there, Tanya. Okay. So I went on my first short-term mission trip when I was 16 years old. My parents called this a reality check trip to teach me that the world did not revolve around me, because I was pretty sure, certain that was happening. And I just wanted my passport stamped for the first time. So I didn't argue, and I accompanied some medical professionals from our church to go to Haiti to set up clinics. And, a 16-year-old girl, I had no idea what I was doing there. My job was to be the girl with the big bag of dum-dum suckers, like handing them out to kids. I had, just no idea. But that trip really, it just kind of launched me really into the rest of my life. And that I ended up taking another trip and another trip and another trip. And by the time I was a junior at Lipscomb University, I began leading teams of college students down there once to twice a year. And we did all your very typical college mission trip kind of stuff. We painted buildings. We did food relief. We loved on kids at orphanages, did VBSs, things like that. And the more that I went, the more I began to feel unsatisfied. And I didn't really know how to verbalize that at the time. I didn't know why I felt that way. But I just kept going back and back, and I didn't seem to be making any difference. I wanted to change the world. I wanted to help people, and I just didn't feel like I was doing anything of significance. And so one night, I remember I was in Haiti on one of these trips, and I was trying to share how I was feeling with my co-leader, who had just happened to be the minister at our church there in Nashville. And I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, "Jillian, you just need to know that the people of Haiti are going to be poor when you get there, and they're going to be poor when you leave, and you need to be okay with that." And I was really angry at him for telling me that. And I was not okay with it. And so a year later, my husband and I packed up our lives in Nashville and moved to Haiti full time, because I thought, if I can't help these people in 7 days, maybe I can help them, you know, if I'm here every day. And so we moved down there, and we spent 7 years there. So, as Tanya was trying to say earlier, we have been all over the spectrum when it comes to short-term mission trips. Both of us have been the participant. We have been the team leader. We've been the recipient. We've been the host. And I just want to go ahead and admit, confession time, I have made every mistake in the book when it comes to short-term missions. And some of those I will share with you as we get into this. So everything that we're going to be talking about today, it is because we have kind of learned it the hard way, and we don't want you to learn it the hard way. So that's what we're sharing. But before I hand this over to Tanya, I do want to say that I really do believe that short-term missions can be really wonderful, both for the people going and for the people receiving. But I also want to be honest and say that I've seen a lot of harm done by short-term mission teams, harm to the locals, harm to the local churches that are being served, harm to organizations, harm to missionaries, and I've even had a lot of harm done to myself by short-term mission teams. And 99% of the time, this harm is done unintentionally, but it happens nonetheless. And so I think the number one reason why short-term mission teams can often hurt those they go to serve is because of misunderstanding and terminology. When we say short-term missions, that implies that our time is short, our obligation is short, our influence is short, when in reality, I believe it's quite the opposite. You may only have your feet planted on foreign soil for a week, but then you get back on that plane and you have left footprints behind. And we need to make sure that those footprints we're leaving behind are footprints that are going to help the people that we went to serve, and not harm them once we leave. And we believe that that all starts with having a long-term vision for what you're doing wherever you go. So, Tanya, let's get started on how to do that.
So, I've been on the receiving end of short-term missions. I live in Utah.
I'm gonna move over to
and as far as on the receiving end, I've experienced a lot of what we're gonna talk about happening or not happening, good and bad. And then I've also been on the receiving end with my work with Emmaus House, but I've also been on the giving end with my work with Emmaus House and with Haiti and traveling to Haiti. So over the last 8 years, I've really seen things done well, and I've seen things done not well, and I've seen what works and what doesn't work. And when you start working long-term in a country, you start seeing what the impact is of these short-term teams and what happens, what actually happens on the ground after they leave. Do they rebuild the bunk beds that everybody just came to build? Do they tear everything down and redo what the Americans all just came to do? And that happens. That does happen. So I want to just look at the Bible for a second and look at short-term missions in the Bible from a biblical perspective, because that's what I started doing. I started thinking about, okay, I'm looking at how things aren't done well, so how can we do it well? And of course, we need to start from God's word. And so I looked at Paul and I looked at Jesus, and Paul and Jesus were both short-term. Jesus was only really doing mission work, if you will, for 3 years. And he didn't stay in one place very long. He was going around to villages. He was going to different places. He was very intentional in what he did and how he did it, though, and we need to do the same. And Paul also was really kind of short-term in on his missionary journeys. The longest he stayed anywhere was Ephesus, which was like 2.5 years. And he stayed in Corinth maybe a year and a half. But everywhere else, He really was in places for a couple months, kind of doing short-term work, but he was very intentional with what he was doing, and his vision was very long-term. So there's 5 points that we want to bring up. So first of all work is cross-cultural work. So I just want to talk about cross-cultural work for a minute. If you're walking across the street to your neighbor's house to teach them the gospel, that's cross-cultural work. Because you know what? Their culture in their home is going to be completely different than the culture in your home. If you're going across the country to another country, that work is going to be very different. I live in Utah. I live in a completely foreign culture, people, just so you know. It is the religion that dominates where I live is a it's a culture. There's a language. There's a everything. It's a culture. And so when I'm there, I have to be mindful of the culture that I live in and the people that I'm teaching the gospel to every day. When I'm in Haiti, I have to be mindful of the culture that I walk into and that I'm teaching people every day. When I come to Oklahoma, the culture is very different here. Guess what? My kids dress a little nicer when they come to church when we come in Oklahoma and Texas and Tennessee than they do at home. And so it's just, we're always mindful of the culture that we're in and the mindset that we have. So from Tennessee to Utah, God sent Jonah to Nineveh, completely different culture. Paul went to Corinth to a completely different culture than he was used to. And so we have to understand the culture. In Acts 17, when Paul went to talk to them, he understood the culture in Athens. He understood that they had all these idols there and what they were going for. He understood what their needs were. He understood what they believed. He understood their faith. And he went to them on that level. And he said, you know, look at these idols, and I'm going to talk to you about this unknown God, this idol that you have to this unknown God. He took them where they were. He didn't start with Old Testament, you know, prophecies. He didn't start with Jesus. He started from where they were. And so we have to understand the culture. In Haiti, what that looks like is, I had to start understanding animism, those beliefs, those voodoo beliefs. And I had to start really understanding Satan and how Satan works there. And I had to start understanding just small things about the church. The church culture is different there. What works, what doesn't work? Why do they believe what they believe? Why do they, you know what, they have kind of a pastoral system in Haiti. They call their preachers pastors, and they kind of serve that role. And the preaching school that this church supports has been working on that for years, kind of trying to change that mindset. So what do? Do we judge them where they are? And do we say, hey, you know what, your doctrine is wrong on that? Or do we work with them where they are? And that's what you have to do. You have to work with them where they are and without this kind of judgmental mindset. We have to respect where they are. So Paul says when he goes in there, he says, I think it's in verse 22, he says, I observe that you are religious in all respects. He treats them with respect. He respects their religion. He respects where they are. He doesn't just come across and say, you know what, these idols, guys, you know, what are you thinking? There's this God that created the universe and there's only one of them. He doesn't do that. He comes in and he says, I respect you. I respect your religion. I respect your faith. And you know what? That is so important when you're dealing with a cross-cultural. Where I work in Utah, It's very easy to just go, wow, you guys really believe you're going to become a god someday, and you really believe you're going to have your own planet, and this polygamy thing and all of that, that's really, there's a lot of crazy in that. But you know what? That is their faith. That is what they believe. My Haitian people that we teach the gospel to there, they truly believe that voodoo exists and that it's real and that it's powerful, and it's a real fear for them. And if we don't validate that, if we just minimize that and go, oh, those are your little beliefs, those are so cute, which I see people do all the time. And if we do that, they're not going to listen to us, and they're not going to love us, and we're not going to build relationship, and we are not showing respect for them. So we need to do like Paul, and we need to have this respect for what they believe, and understand that even though it's not scriptural or it's not, we don't agree with them, that we need to have a respect that this is truly where their faith is and this is truly where they are. And in order to do that, we have to go in with this attitude of service. And so I'm going to let Jillian go in there.
All right. So the second thing we think we need to do to have long-term visions when it comes to ministry is having compassion, not pity. And it took me a really long time to realize that there were differences in these words. And what it comes down to is compassion and pity. And with both of them, you have this feeling of sympathy towards somebody. But with pity, you have that sympathy, and then you just kind of let it go. It is your classic, like, scrolling through Facebook. You see somebody post, like, some dog in an animal shelter, and you push the little, like, sad face emoji with the tear, and then you just keep scrolling. You don't have any, like, response to do anything about that. But pity is taking that compassion, turning it into empathy, and then doing something about it to relieve that person from their suffering. Over and over in the Gospels, we see Jesus having compassion on people. He saw people who were hungry, and he had compassion, and he fed them. We saw where he had compassion on people who were lost, and so he taught them. He had compassion on people who were sick, and so he healed them. And every instance where the scripture says he had compassion, it's immediately followed by him doing what was necessary to relieve that person's suffering. Now, here is what I've witnessed in Haiti. It is really easy when you're on a short-term mission trip, or even when you're living there full-time, it is really easy to go in to that culture where there's such poverty and have pity on the people, to see how they're living and just to feel so bad for them. And while that doesn't seem like a bad thing, I want to try to put it in their perspective. And so I want you to just imagine with me for 1 minute, and I realize we're like a room full of women plus a couple, but just imagine that you are a Haitian father. I'm going to give you a really Haitian name. Your name is Jean-Louis. And you live in the countryside of Haiti. You have never been anywhere outside of your little community, nowhere that takes longer than a day on a motorcycle. You've just stayed in this area your whole life. That's your only understanding of the world, is this little countryside. You live on a piece of land that you inherited from your family. You are building the house that your family lives in. It's incomplete because you can only build as you have money. So you make a little money, you build a little. You make a little money, you build a little. And it's not much, but you're really proud of it because you're doing it yourself. You live there with your wife and your 3 kids. You make money building cement blocks. And your wife sells goats and chickens that she raises on your little piece of property. Your 3 girls go to school. But because you don't have a lot of money, you can't afford to send them to a private school. And so they go to the government school that's in town. And because the government doesn't always pay their teachers, the teachers don't always come to school. So really, your girls only go to school, you know, every so often. But that's the best you can do. So anyway, one day you're out working in your yard, the lacoon, and your wife is sitting on the front porch braiding your neighbor's hair, and your 3 little girls are not in school that day, and they're running around half naked because it's like 100 degrees outside. So you're just out there working, and all of a sudden a big truck comes by and just stops in front of your house. And one by one, a bunch of white people step out into your yard. And you don't know who these people are. You've never met them before. You don't know why they're there. And they come up to you, and they start speaking in a language you've never heard before. You know that it's English, but you don't have a clue. Few of them are pulling out their big cell phones, and they start taking pictures of your half-naked kids. Some of them are whipping what you think is candy, you're hoping it's candy, out of their pockets, passing it to your kids. You see your wife on the porch, and she's all in distress. She's in her nightgown, her hair is all crazy, and she's looking at these women who have nice clothes and big wedding rings, and their hair is all nice, and you can tell she's embarrassed. And then all of a sudden, they start praying for you. At least you think they're praying for you. Again, you still don't understand. Some of them are crying as they're looking at your house. And then they hand you this big bag of rice and beans. You say thank you. They get in their truck, and they leave. And there you are, standing with this big bag of rice and beans, kind of thankful because that's going to be nice for dinner that night, but also completely embarrassed that in front of your kids, in front of your wife, in front of your neighbors, here these people came to you, had pity on you, took pictures of your naked kids, handed you food, and assumed this is what you needed. And that may seem like a crazy story, but confession time again, I have been that person in the back of that truck more times than I would like to admit. That was my life doing short-term missions for a long time. And I've gone to people's houses unexpectedly. I have been the person with the camera. I've been the person with the candy. I've been the crazy lady crying. And I am sad to think of how many people I put in that situation. To be on the recipient end of pity can be dehumanizing and humiliating. And I'm pretty sure that's not how we want the people to feel when we go to serve them. To have compassion on someone, however, is to help them not because we feel bad for them, but because we're in relationship with them and we value them and we want to give them dignity. In this example of the team in the back of the truck, compassion would have been getting to know the father before showing up at his house, knowing what his true needs were. Compassion would have been asking him what he really needed instead of just assuming what he needed. Compassion would have been respecting his home and his family. Compassion would have been helping him in a way that would raise him up as a person and not humiliate him in front of his family and his neighbors. So when we seek to dignify those we serve, when we want to have compassion and not pity, and when we have compassion and not pity, then we can enter into true relationship with people, and that's where we can really help them.
And a way that we do that is we go into, I skipped a whole part here, I realized. we need to go into it with knowing that we're going to be investing in relationships. I missed this whole part about the culture part. That was really cool. Investing in relationships. So we did. I messed up a lot when I started going in 2010. But one thing that I'm so grateful that I did do for those first 2 years before we started Amaya's House, when I was going back to Haiti and back and forth, is I'm just the kind of person that asks a lot of questions, and I get to know people, and I want to know, and I want to understand what's, I just like to understand. And so I took those first 2 years, and I was so glad that I did. And this wasn't out of wisdom or knowledge or anything. I just did it because it's who I am. I got to know some people, and I really got to build a relationship with Jillian, and I really got to build a relationship with Jerome, who's now our administrator for Emmaus House. And I got to know some of the kids that are now our students at Emmaus House. And I really built those relationships, and I understood them, and I asked questions about the culture, and why do you do it this way, and why do you do it that way, and why is it like this, and what do you think the solutions are, and what do you think the problems are. And I really kind of took that time to do that before we started Amaya's House, and I think that was God's providence, because it's not something that I would have done just out of wisdom on my own. I think that was God. So when Paul went places, so in Acts chapter 11, Agabus kind of gives this, there's going to be a famine and in Judea. And then as it goes on through Acts, this kind of plays out. And how it plays out is the church in Jerusalem realizes that all these churches that Paul had started are struggling, and they're struggling with what to do with the law, and, you know, how do they mix in with the Gentiles and all of that. And they're all kind of struggling. Well, what was going to happen, and this was God's providence, what was going to happen was God was going to create the situation where the church in Jerusalem had a need, which was there was going to be a famine, and they needed financial help. And then all of the churches in the Gentile churches all really needed guidance, and they needed wisdom, and they needed that spiritual leadership. And so God kind of created this situation where there could be relationship, and there could be this giving to one another in different ways. So the church in Jerusalem, they had the council, and they sent out the decree, all of the, you know, don't eat meat sacrifice idols, blah, 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 all of that. They sent all that to encourage the churches and to teach them and to guide them and provide leadership. And then the churches in the Gentile churches were sending money and were collecting money on that second missionary journey that Paul went on. So God created this environment where they could bring these two cultures together and create relationship. And I'm so grateful for the relationships that I have in Haiti and also in Utah where I live. But when Paul would go around, he would take two or three people with him, and what they would do is they would strengthen the leadership everywhere that they went. They would appoint elders. They would strengthen the elders. They would strengthen the leadership, and they would get to know. When you read Paul's letters, he knew those people. He knew their struggles. He knew their victories. He knew them. He loved them. He had relationship. He knew the individuals in the church, even if he'd only been there a couple months at a time. He was writing letters. He was sending people on his behalf. He had this depth of relationship with the churches that he was with short term. And so it wasn't just this, I'm going to go there and then I'm going to leave and come back and I'll pray for them and remember that and that really changed my life. That was not what Paul did. Paul went with an intention and with a vision to create a big, to create a difference when he was there. And so he had these deep relationships. You have to know them. You have to know people if you're going to have an impact at all. You have to have that relationship. You have to build them. And when people, so we've had people come to Utah, different churches, which I've been grateful for, and we've had some groups that have been great groups, and we've had some groups that have done a lot of damage when they came, unintentionally. So we had a group come in, and they came in and they looked at our carpet, and they were like, we need to just change this carpet, but we can only do it in this one room. Well, what they didn't realize was we had been saving money for carpet for our church building, and so they changed it in this one room, and it wasn't going to be what we wanted for the rest of our, and so it kind of threw off our whole, and they just kind of came in, and they just started, well, you guys need this, and you guys need this, and you guys need this, and we just felt very, well, I guess you guys are the ones with the money, you guys are the ones, so I guess we'll just stand back and let you do it, and that's what we did, and it felt so disempowering. We felt so helpless. Is the feeling. We just felt helpless and we couldn't say anything because, again, they were the ones that had the money and they were willing to give it and they came all this way to help us. And it really helped me understand how the Haitians feel when we go and we just come and we say, well, we're going to do this, we're going to do this, we're going to do this. That first trip that we went, we saw at the back of the orphanage, we saw just this, basically where all the sewage, there's no sewage system, so it's all the sewage kind of going, the showers and all of that, going to the canal, kind of going in, going out to the street, and it was really flooded and it was gross. So we were like, we'll bring in all this rock and we'll, you know, build this big thing. And because that's what everybody wants to do, right? They want to do something that they can feel good about. Look at this thing I did. I can take pictures of it. I can take it back. I can show all the people that supported me. I can do that. And so that's what we did. We did that. And guess what? We came back the next year. And it was even more flooded because you know what we had done? We had just brought in a bunch of dirt and rocks to create even a bigger mess. So then we were like, well, let's fix it again. So we fixed it again. Well, by the third year, my husband caught on and I caught on. And you know what we said to one of the guys that works at the orphanage? We said, why don't you fix it and we'll help you? And you know what? He went and he like got started. He got all the people there. He got the concrete. He got everything. And it is to this day, when I go back, it's beautiful. It's this beautiful canal that goes all the way around, and it just, it's not flooded at all, and it's perfect. And I hate that we had to learn that the hard way. And I hate to think that how we made those people feel. And so when we go, we have to have those relationships. We have to have that mindset of we're going with a long-term vision. Paul had a long-term vision. Jesus had a long-term vision. He was intentional and purposeful. In Mark chapter 16, at the end of Mark, after Jesus has died and he's raised and everything, he's done all of his work with his 12, right? He had his group, and he was intentional with them, and he trained them, and he got them and go into all the world, and they were getting ready, they were doing all of that. And in Mark 16, verse 20, there's an interesting little tidbit there. It says, and they went out and preached everywhere, and it says, and the Lord went with them. So Jesus had done all of this. He trained them. He'd gotten them ready to go. He'd given them what they needed. And they went out into all the world, and he was still with them. He was still by them. He was still supporting them. He was still from heaven giving them what they needed to do what they needed to do. But he had trained them. He spent his 3 years. He did what he needed to do, and then he left. He came with a long-term vision. I mean, it was an eternal vision. That's a whole other thing. But
long-term.
Yeah, it's long-term. Eternity is long-term. So when you go, ask what the people need. Ask them what they need. Don't just assume what they need. And don't ask them to accommodate what you need, because that happens so often. Well, we want to come and we want to build something. What can we build? We want to come and we want to hand out rice and beans. Tell us where to do that. Where's a good place to do that? That's not what I mean. Sit down with them. ask them, what do you guys really need? We did that once. We had all the church leaders around, and we said, what do you guys really need? And it wasn't what we thought. It wasn't what we thought. And so we changed our trajectory of Emmaus House based on what the church leaders in that area said that they needed. And so we have to have trusted, like-minded partnership. That's what we need to be doing. We need to be building that even when we go short-term. I've been a short-term missionary now for 7 years. I've never lived in Haiti. I go for 2 weeks at a time, twice a year. So, but every time I go, it's with this long-term vision. And the people that I bring with me, even if they're only going to come one time, they're going to have a long-term vision too. But we all like those short-term results, right? We all like that. We all like that just really quick. I'm just going to get this done, and we're going to have a picture to take with us. So anyway, it doesn't always work that way. So go ahead.
That's a good lead-in to our next point. How much time do we have, Tom?
We have, that's a good idea. We've got 15 minutes.
Okay. So Tanya's example of the canal at the orphanage is a great lead-in to what I'm going to say. I'm going to keep doing some light confessions about myself because that's biblical, right? When I moved to Haiti, I really thought that I was like a Christian superhero. I thought like my calling was to go out and save the people of Haiti, to give them everything they didn't have, to teach them everything they didn't know, to do for them everything I thought they couldn't do themselves. If any of you said, Jillian, I'm going to give you a pink cape and bedazzle it for you, I would have taken it, I would have worn it, I would have loved it. But thankfully, God humbled me pretty quickly after I got there. But that first couple years that we were there, my husband and I worked for an orphanage that had been around for a couple decades. And it was really run down when we got there. And so when we came in, within that very first week there, I remember sitting in our little living room and making a list of everything we thought this orphanage needed to make it better. And we never consulted a single staff person at the orphanage, never talked to the youth, didn't talk to anybody. This was just like our own ideas, and us being just the young, like, millennials out to save the world that we were, we thought, we're just going to do this all on our own. We've got this. And so we made this list. It was 2 pages long, back and front, single-spaced, size 11 font. We printed it out. We put it on our fridge, and we just started working, checking it off one by one. And it didn't take us too long into the first page that we just got completely burned out, mainly because we were doing it all by ourselves. We were inviting teams nonstop to come down and help us do this, but none of our staff would help us. Unless we were willing to pay them extra money, which we weren't willing to do, none of them were helping us with all these projects. And at first we were super offended. We thought, my goodness, we have left our homes in America. You know, we'd go through this whole thing of all these things we've sacrificed to come here and help them. And they were just taking advantage of us. They were just lazy. They weren't helping. They were just sitting back and watching us. You know, it's great. And then we finally learned to take those capes off and set them aside and realize that what we were doing, this attitude that we had, these actions we were having, were really offensive and were really hurting our staff. I mean, here we had come into their home, into their workplace, without consulting them, without understanding their culture at all, without understanding the history of this orphanage at all, and assuming we knew all the problems and that we had all the solutions to fix it. So I was being a savior, not a servant. And that really hurt my time there for the first couple years. I'm going to read a quote from this book. It's called We Are Not the Hero. It's another great one to stick into your Amazon cart. But this quote is from a church leader out of Kenya, Africa. And somebody asked him, if you could tell North Americans one thing, who come to do mission work in your country, what would you want to tell them? And this is what he said. Oh, you Americans, you have an amazing capacity to resolve problems. Now, this is a great thing about Americans, the ability to innovate and resolve problems. The downside of that is that when you come into my context, you don't know how to live with my problems. You see our poverty, you see our need, you see the places we're hurting, and you have a great compassion to come and solve us.
life can't be solved that way. Many times, well-intentioned Americans will come into our contacts and they try to fix my life. But you can't fix my life. What I need is a brother who comes and gives me a shoulder to cry on and gives me space to express my pain, but doesn't try to fix me. When Jesus came into the world, he did not try to come fix all the poverty, all the sickness, all the need, all the political situations. He allowed that to be. But instead, he spoke grace and salvation and redemption within that context, because that is the greatest hope than life itself. So, I really, looking back on my time in Haiti, especially those first few years at the orphanage, what our staff needed was not me to come in and save them. They didn't need a savior. That was Jesus, right? And I was trying to replace that for some reason. What they needed was a sister to come in and listen to them, to come in and try to attempt to understand their struggles. They needed a partner with resources, which I had, to help them help the orphanage, to help them fix what they thought needed to be fixed. The last thing they needed was this crazy white lady who didn't understand anything about their culture coming in trying to solve their problems for them. But I love what that leader out of Kenya said, that when Jesus was here on earth, he focused on serving people, not fixing systems, not doing projects. And I think this is something we often miss in short-term missions, is that we focus so much on projects and not people. In Philippians 2, 5 through 8, Paul tells us that we should have the same mind of Christ. And I'm going to read that really quickly. He says, "In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in the very nature of God, did not consider equality with God something to be used for his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness, and being found in appearance as man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross." So Jesus humbled himself when he came to earth so he could raise other people up around him. If you are an American, whether you intend to or not, whenever you step into a culture of poverty, they are going to see you up here. Because you have a U.S. passport. You have wealth, you have power, whether you are trying to have that impression on them or not, they're going to see you up here. And that's where the Savior goes. And they are going to see themselves as down here because they do not have wealth, they do not have power, they do not have a U.S. passport. And how can you truly have relationship with people when there's such a divide? And so our job when we step into their culture is to try to break the divide, is to try to meet in the middle. As we humble ourselves the way Jesus did, our job is to raise them up as Jesus raised those up around him so that we can be on equal grounds. Threw my paper down to the ground. And this can take a really long time, way more than a week-long mission trip. I mean, I've been in Haiti since, well, I don't even know when, but a really long time. I moved down there in 2011. I live in the States now, but I go back quite frequently, and I still am working this out with some people. Some people still view me up here, and it's really hard. But Jesus was the perfect example of this. Looking back on that passage in Philippians, I love where it says that he took on the appearance of a man. And this is something I think we also forget to do a lot of times in short-term missions, is that when we step into another culture, and Tanya kind of mentioned this before, just embracing that culture. So Jesus came down from heaven, and he completely took on the culture of man on earth. He took their form. He knew that in order to serve the people in the best way, he had to become like them so he could understand them, so he could relate to them, so he could be in relationship with them. So what did he do? He became man. He dressed like man. He ate like man. He spoke like man. He lived like them. And we need to do that when we go on short-term missions too. We need to be willing to become a part of that culture in order to humble ourselves and raise them up at the same time. Now, if I could go back in time and speak to the Jillian as she's, like, packing up her suitcases, getting ready to move to Haiti, I would have said a lot of things. But what I would have said first is, don't go do a single project for an entire year. Instead, you should focus all your energy on becoming a servant in the eyes of the staff and the children of the orphanage. You are not their savior. Jesus is. Just go learn to be their friend. Learn their culture, learn their language, learn to cook their food, learn to sing their songs, learn their fears, learn their dreams. And then, once you've broken that divide between you, then you can get to work together. So, when we are willing to be servants and not saviors, then we can take time to be purposeful and intentional, which is our last point.
So being purposeful and intentional, because what she's describing you can't do in a week. You can't do that in 2 weeks. But there is a huge purpose to 1 week, 2 week mission trips. If we are purposeful and if we're intentional, if we take the time ahead of time to think about, okay, what are we doing? Why are we doing it? Why are we going? Let's do that. Let's learn. Let's take some time. Jillian's taking a group in October to Haiti, and they've been doing tons. They've been meeting once a week, and they've been talking about Haiti. They've been learning about the culture. They've been learning about our kids and the trauma that they've endured. They've been learning about how to deal with the culture, with our kids, with how to teach them Jesus. And they're planning a youth rally, if you will. And they ask them, what do you guys want to learn about? It's not a topic I would have picked. Not a topic she would have picked. But what was the topic they chose?
Prostitution.
Prostitution. That's what they wanted to learn about. That's what the youth there want to learn about. Not a topic I would have chosen for a short-term mission team to lead. But you know what? They're going to do it, and it's going to be great.
Then they asked to start with a skit.
We are.
We're working on it.
Can I stick around for that?
We'll Facebook Live it. I don't know.
But learning to figure that out, learning to work with that, learning to, it's a challenge, and we're learning it. We are still learning as we go, for sure. But being intentional. Paul was intentional with designating leadership where he went. Jesus was intentional with the 12, with working with them and being patient with them. It's kind of just what we've been talking about, just being intentional, being purposeful. Jesus was intentional with every area that he went to. When he went across the sea, he was intentional over there with what he did. And then he was intentional about coming back. He was intentional about the woman at the well, that area of Samaria. He was intentional with his conversation with her and how that was going to spread the gospel in that area. Paul was intentional with Ephesus. So he brings Timothy along. He kind of picks him up and takes him along. And then he brings Silas along. And guess who? He picks up Aquila and Priscilla and develops relationships with them. And he sees that Ephesus is a pretty big hub, and that's where a lot of people come and go from. And you know what? He spent 2.5 years there. He spent most of his time there as far as short-term missions. And he left some of his most trusted people there. He left Timothy there. He trained Timothy, and then he left him there. And then he left Aquila and Priscilla there for a short time to help lead the church, to help things be. And so although all of his mission trips, all of his time was short-term, he very much was very intentional, and he was very purposeful, and he had a vision for what he was doing and why he was doing it. So short-term missions can be effective and they can be valuable, but we have to think about it. We can't just plan a trip and go. We have to be intentional, and we have to work with the people who are already working on the ground there. Jillian and I, we're already working on the ground there. Jerome, he's already working on the ground there. Don't just show up somewhere. Work with the people who are already working there. So, all right, so we wanted to just give a quick
review. So how much time we have?
2 minutes.
2 minutes. Okay, so I'm going to give you a quick rundown on Emmaus House for the last 2 minutes. So once my husband, his name is Hunter, once we were willing to stop, like, trying to fix everybody's problems and really get to the heart of the people at our orphanage, we began seeing just a lot of holes in the orphan care system. And then one of the things that really bothers most, and we knew bothered Tanya, is that there was no plan for these kids at the orphanage, that eventually they were going to age out, and chances of them have any success in life was slim to none. And so over and over again, we had seen youth who had aged out of the orphanage end up in prison, end up on the streets, end up in prostitution, And so we decided, okay, if we're going to do this orphan care thing, we need to do it right. And we need to have a long-term vision for these kids. And so one day I just called up Tanya and I said, hey, do you want to start something? And she said, okay. And we had no idea what we were doing, but we trusted God that he did. And in 2013, my husband and I stepped down from our positions there, and with Tanya's help back in the States, we started Emmaus House. And Emmaus House is a transition home, as I said before we got started, that helps these youth kind of go into adulthood successfully. And so when we first started, our primary goal was just to serve those kids coming out of the orphanage. But the more we've been open, the more God has opened doors for us to serve other populations of orphaned youth in our area. So youth coming off the streets, youth who have grown up as domestic slaves, which is quite common in Haiti. One out of every 15 kids is a domestic slave in Haiti. And then kids who...
prostitution.
Yeah, yeah.
Girls who've been kind of sex trafficked.
Right.
We're working with that.
And so... right now, we're going through a season of growth, which is super exciting, and yes, it's super exciting and a lot of work, but we are building our own property. We have rented a couple houses for the past, I guess, 6 years, and now we are building our own campus, and once that campus is complete, we are going to be able to double the size of youth, the amount of youth that we're able to serve at one time, and on that property, we'll also include what we're calling the Refuge House, which will be a special home just for girls who have come out of sexual traumas and who have been trafficked and have grown up in just some pretty horrifying situations that just need that extra intensive therapeutic care. So if you would love to learn more about us, there is our website. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram. You can come grab a brochure. There's magnets on the table. You can put it on your fridge and think of us every time you grab a drink.
Pray for us.
And yeah, pray for us for sure, because
we need it.
just come talk to us. We love talking about
And you don't have to be a member of the church to be accepted into our program, but I'll tell you, all the kids that have come to our program that have not been Christians, all of them have become Christians by being in our program. It goes a long way when you connect and you meet and you love people. It goes a long way. And yeah, so thank you very much. We are only 1 minute over, so thank you so much for your time.